To understand the setting the context for this parable from Jesus, you need to understand our passage from Isaiah. And to understand that, you need to go back a chapter and look at chapter 24, which is sometimes referred to as Isaiah's apocalypse. It begins, "Now the Lord is about to lay waste the earth and make it desolate." And it pretty much continues on in that vein. But there's a turn in the last verse, as the chapter concludes with the Lord of hosts establishing his reign on earth. And that leads into a hymn of praise to God. And then to our passage this morning. On this mountain, on Mount Zion, on the mountain of the temple, the mountain of Jerusalem, after he has judged the earth, the Lord will prepare a feast, not just for Israel, but for all the nations. He will swallow up the shroud of death that covers the nations and keeps them from seeing his glory. And Jew and Gentile alike will receive his salvation. And the Jews understood, came to understand over time, that this great banquet was related to the coming of the Messiah. But there was a key part of that vision from Isaiah that they rejected. The idea that the Messiah's banquet would include all the nations, not just the Jews. And so, you know, later, as Hebrew came to be a forgotten language for the people of Israel, you know, they mostly spoke a related language called Aramaic. The texts of the Old Testament were sort of translated with commentary, you know, what were known as the Targums. And one of the Aramaic versions of this passage renders verse 6 this way. In this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all the peoples a meal. And though they suppose it is an honor, it will be a shame for them. And great plagues, plagues from which they will be unable to escape, plagues whereby they will come to their end. Whoever was responsible for that passage couldn't accept the idea that God might bless non-Jews. So they narrowed it. And over time, that narrowing process continued, excluding unrighteous Jews, and then anyone with any sort of physical blemish. Only those worthy to earn an invitation would be welcome. This is where the dinner guest is coming from in Luke 14, and this is why he says, "Blessed is the one, you know, who eats in the kingdom of God." It's not a very inclusive understanding of how this was going to go. And no doubt, he expected an equally conventional response. He wasn't thinking to provoke a challenge. But that's what he gets. And once again, Jesus sets the scene very briefly. A rich man gave a dinner party. We know he's a rich man by the scale of this. And in fact, the sort of scale he's talking about, we're probably not talking just even the village, but, you know, someone who is maybe one of the richest men in one of the cities of the nation. And he sends out the invitations, and he sends them out with an RSVP so that he'll know how many are coming, because how many are coming determines what kind of meat you serve. Remember, every calculation goes off the fact that there is no such thing as refrigeration, and this is a hot climate. So, you know, it's sort of like the electricity with our power system now. I mean, you produce it, you eat it, same day, and that's the end of the story. So for a few guests, it might be a chicken or two, or perhaps a duck. For 10 to 15, you'd need to kill a goat. Larger number than that would require a sheep. If you're talking 35 or more, you would need to butcher a calf. And indeed, you could keep working your way on up from there with various combinations. But once they'd have butchered the appropriate animal or animals, it had to be eaten that day. And so once you accepted the invitation, you were duty-bound to come so that none of the host's food would go to waste. You know, accepting an invitation to a party was not a minor thing in that culture. So he sends out his invitations. You know, he gets the responses. You know, he knows what his guest list looks like. He sets the preparations in motion. And then, you know, as they are nearly complete, he sends out his servant to tell those whom he has invited that the feast is ready. They've all accepted the invitations. They have promised to be there. But to his surprise, now that it's time for them to come, they refuse. Which was a considerable insult to their host. But then, they offer excuses which can only have been calculated to increase the insult. For whatever reason, this man's invited guests, his peers, have apparently ganged up and decided to give him a slap in the face and completely to dishonor him in front of the entire community. And so the first guest says, "I bought a piece of land and I must go out and see it. Please accept my regrets." Maybe you don't fully get the force of that, but put yourself in this guy's shoes. Imagine you're throwing a big party, major celebration, and just as you're getting ready and waiting by the door, all of a sudden a guest comes up and says, "I'm not coming. I just bought a house down in Indy. I've never seen it before. I don't know where it is. So I have to go look it over and check out the neighborhood." Are you going to believe them? No. Do you think they would expect you to? Of course not. The excuse is ridiculous. Who would buy a piece of property about which they knew nothing? And if that's true now, it was even truer then, where there were, there was a lot more attached to land in that culture, since it was the main source of wealth, the main form of wealth. And really, with the land was the survival for the family that owned it. And the process of buying a piece of land was so involved it could take years. Presbyterian missionary to Syria, the Reverend William M. Thompson, said this: "It is not enough that you purchase a well-known lot. The contract must mention everything that belongs to it and certify that fountains or wells in it, trees upon it, etc., are sold with the field. Thus, Abraham bought this field and the cave that was therein, and all the trees that were in the field and that were in all the borders round about were made sure. You knew a piece of land intimately before you bought it, and every detail that could possibly be of importance was specified and spelled out. So this excuse is a joke, and everyone knows it." And to make it worse, the guest says, "I must go out and see it. And I must do it right now." What he's saying with this is, this land is more important to me than my relationship with you. Which, of course, take the insult and square it. So that's bad. It gets worse. The next excuse is even more preposterous. Imagine a friend calling you up, after this guy just has, and saying, "I can't come to the party. I just bought 5 used cars over the phone, and I have to go find out their make, model, age, and mileage and see if they'll start." No one would buy a team of oxen without testing them first, and all testing was done in public to see how well they pulled together. The idea of buying 5 sight unseen is completely unfathomable. This excuse is just as transparently false as the first one. And it's even more insulting, because after all, fields are land, and land is holy. But oxen are animals. One thing to say, that land is more important than the host, but oxen? Big, dumb, smelly things? Still, you have to at least give this man the credit that, like the first, he was at least civil. He at least pretended to be apologetic. The same cannot be said on any level of the third one. And again, we might miss that. Yeah, we see in our English translation, she just got married, and we think, okay, it's his wedding night, and we can understand this. But no, remember what we've talked about before, yeah, some of the parables dealing with wedding banquets. If that had been his wedding night, the entire community would have been there. He wouldn't have scheduled a banquet when everybody was at a wedding. Nobody would have come. You know, he would have gotten no response when he sent out the invitations. So this guy has been married for some period of time. And when he accepted the invitation, he already knew that he was married. So this is not a last-minute sort of thing. It's not a true conflict. Going along with this, men in that culture were supposed to be very reserved when talking about women in public settings. Very, very different mores this way than what we're used to. I mean, men would freely hug each other, kiss each other in public, and walk down the street holding hands, which seems very odd in our culture, but any demonstration of affection toward women or even talking about it at all, you didn't do. That was private. And in particular, sex was intensely private. It was not to be even alluded to in public. And so this guy's extremely rude. He essentially says, I know I said I'd come to your banquet, but remember, I got married not long ago, and this afternoon my wife, well, you get the picture, I'm not coming. I mean, he doesn't even bother to send his regrets. As Kenneth Bailey notes, the entire response is guaranteed to infuriate the most patient of hosts, East or West. And he's enraged. You can't blame him. He's just taken a number of nasty public insults. And indeed, he's invited many, and they've all refused, so we're just getting a sampling here. It may well be worse than that, although I'm not quite sure how you would imagine that. And along with that, of course, he has a problem. What to do with all the food? His delinquent guests are sure that they've dealt him a humiliating defeat, because obviously the feast can't go on without them. It will all go to waste. The host has been impoverished for nothing. He's been embarrassed and humiliated. But he rises above them. And he responds with grace. He does something they could never have comprehended. He decides that if those who would be considered worthy of his banquet will not come, then he'll invite the unworthy. And he sends his servant out into the city to bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame. Those who are physically blemished and therefore not perfect enough to matter. Not perfect enough to count. Not perfect enough to be welcome at the banquet of the Lord. This, of course, would enrage his original guests, both for the implied insult and, of course, because their attempt to prevent the banquet has failed. And so as he does this, he's courting retaliation from them. But he does it anyway. He does it anyway. So the servant goes out, and he gathers in the lowest of the low and the despised of the community. He brings in the beggars and the shiftless. And then he comes back to report that he's carried out his instructions, but there's still room at the feast. Got to say one thing for this guy. When he does a party, he does it right. And so the host gives him a further command. He says, okay, go out beyond the bounds of the community. Go out into the highways and out into the side roads. And gather in everyone that you can find. Bring people in to fill the tables. And this is an even more staggering command than the first, and not least to those who are suddenly receiving this invitation. Because in that culture, an unexpected invitation must be refused. And especially if the guest was of lower status than the host. It was a matter of honor. And a matter of practicality. I mean, it's what Jesus is alluding to at the beginning of the passage that we read this morning. Because if someone invited you to their banquet, you are supposed to reciprocate. And obviously, if you are just passing through the community, or if you're blind and a beggar on the street, you can't possibly There's no way on earth that you could return the favor that you were given. And so clearly, they would think, this was just a gesture. For whatever reason, they wouldn't pretend to know, but not something that was meant to be taken seriously. It was an invitation that was meant to be refused and thus ought to be refused, because if somebody doesn't really want you to come and you accept their invitation anyway, there's just no good that comes of that. So the servant, as he goes out, needs to make them come. He needs to compel them, not with force, but with reassurance. That yes, in fact, as unbelievable as it is, this invitation is completely sincere. That they are wanted, that they are welcomed, and they need to come now. And Jesus' hearers would have been as completely flabbergasted and flummoxed as the new guests in the parable. Because whatever the merits of the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame, at least they're members of the community. We are at least talking Jews here. To some degree, at least, they belong. They are part of the community, however much on the fringes. They have an interest in the welfare of the city. They have at least some very tenuous connection with the host. But outsiders? Foreigners? To Jesus' audience, that was beyond comprehension. And make no mistake, they knew what he meant. I mean, we see there's a lot of Jesus' parables that confuse his audience. You know, there's some that his disciples have to come along afterwards and say, Jesus, what did you mean by that? But this one's very clear. They knew what they were talking about. They knew what he was talking about when he started. They knew what the guest was talking about when he said, you know, blessed is the one who will, you know, eat in the kingdom of God. They know this language. They know this imagery, and they get his point. It's very, very clear. This is Isaiah's banquet, and Jesus is telling them that there are some who expect to be there who aren't going to be there. And they'll be excluded by their own hand because they have rejected God's invitation. And in their place, in the place of the ones that everybody is sure are way high on God's list, not least of all themselves, in place of the ones that anybody would look to and call righteous, in place of the ones who obviously have this whole religion thing together, will be many whom the world calls unworthy, and many outsiders, which, remember, that includes us. Those who accept the invitation will be there. Those who refuse it because they have rejected the servant, Jesus, won't. They'll be outside. Doesn't matter how they argue. Jesus makes that clear with his closing comment. And I tweaked the NIV a little bit. It's fairly common to take that as being sort of the last comment of the master within the parable. But in fact, Jesus changes the language here. I mean, all the way through you have the master addressing his servant and the you is singular. Here it's plural. He's shifting out of that. This is not Jesus telling the story and the host talking to his servant. This is Jesus talking to those who are gathered with him around the table. He's telling them directly, none of those who are invited will taste my banquet. Part of what he's doing here is he's making his own identity in this one very, very clear. He is the Messiah. This is his feast. And who is there depends on him. And those whose names were originally on the guest list have excluded themselves. And their self-exclusion is final. It's important to understand this, because this is the thing that the Pharisees just didn't get. The banquet of the Messiah is not for good church-going people who live moral lives. It isn't for respectable folks who are upstanding members of society. It isn't for those who stand for traditional values. Not that any of those are necessarily excluded. It isn't not for them either. But you can't get in that way. Living a moral life won't get you in the door. Campaigning for biblical values won't earn you a ticket. Even faithfully attending church won't qualify you. There is no earthly way that you can, by your actions, rack up enough points to garner yourself an invitation. The only way in is through the servant, the Messiah, Jesus. The banquet of the Messiah isn't for those who think they deserve to be there. It's only for those who know they don't. It isn't for those who think they're good enough to make it by their own work. It's for those who know they'll only make it by the grace of God. It's by His grace alone. For those who accept that the only way is grace alone, through Christ alone. Let's pray.